Thank you, Dale, for contributing to the diversity of these topics. We're going to hear about prescribed fire here and in the Sierra for us. And is biomass for energy a better alternative? Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for letting me back in, Dan. It's going to be a little bit different take on the energy situation here. I'm going to talk about prescribed fire. And Kim Rollins is a resource economist who helped a little bit with this. She's done most of her work in the Great Basin, pinyon juniper, cheatgrass, but tried to contribute a little bit to this issue in the Sierra Nevada. So a lot of you have heard this before. We have a fire problem in the Southwest. We have excessive fuels in the forest because of the misguided policy of complete fire suppression after the 1910 catastrophic wildfires that occurred. And all that did was cause a buildup of fuel, which made wildfire inevitable. This is a fire system. It will burn. And now the fire, instead of staying on the forest floor, crawls up into the canopy and takes out the entire stand because of ladder fuels. So I stole this picture from the Northern Arizona University website. This is how things looked before the era of fire suppression. Park-like, you could ride a horse through there. This is a ponderosa pine forest, and it had a fire interval, at least in the Tahoe Basin area. I know it was between a 5 and a 15-year fire interval. So the understory was kept down all the time. This is Roger Walker, one of my cohorts, standing on one of our research sites in South Lake Tahoe. You see a lot of white fur there and a lot of dead fuel, and that's what we call ladder fuels. If a fire starts in this system, which it did, it will burn up into the canopy. It won't stay in the forest floor. So in contrast to most of the rest of speakers trying to grow biomass and grow fuels, we're trying to get rid of it. And the question is how best to get rid of it. Do we want to burn it? Do we want to try to harvest it, use it for cogeneration, mechanical treatment? Both options are not so much the cogen these days, but both mechanical and fire are being used routinely now where possible to get rid of this fuel. In this particular site, I reported on it a few years ago here in the South Lake Tahoe, we had a fire and fire mitigation study where we did prescribed fire, mechanical treatment, and both, all set up and ready to go. And the local regulatory agency, Tahoe Regional Planning Agency, refused to let us implement it because we might cause some erosion. So meanwhile, some idiot threw a cigarette from a gondola out of right nearby Heavenly Valley ski area and burned up half our plots. And so we had a wildfire study suddenly. I'm not going to report on that today. The issue is prescribed fire. There's a picture from where I used to live, the Martis Fire 2002. Almost got into Lake Tahoe. What I don't have a picture of is the Gondola Fire, the Angora Fire in Lake Tahoe, South Lake Tahoe. I think it was 2007. It only burned 3,000 acres, but it consumed 250 plus or minus homes. And so I did a back of the envelope calculation, 300K per house. That probably in property damage ran around 50,000 per acre of cost just due to property damage, let alone fire suppression, rehabilitation, and all the rest of it. So that's what you end up with after one of these crown fires. Forest floor is completely consumed. A lot of times, nearly all of the foliage is completely consumed. Seldom, if ever, is the woody material completely consumed. And so, as you've probably heard, there's been big arguments and issues about salvage logging, post-fire salvage logging. I don't plan to get into that today, but this is typically what happens immediately after a wildfire in these kinds of systems. And not too long after that, you typically have this, a chaparral system comes in. This is mostly Ceanothus valutinus, which in fact is a nitrogen fixer. And our studies have indicated it improves the soil nitrogen, not only nitrogen, but it actually improves the base cation status. It does not do what red alder does not produce excessive nitrate. And therefore, it doesn't poison itself out of the system. And the local foresters will say that unless something's done in a situation like this, this condition will persist for 50 to 100 years before it comes back to forest. So you have to herbicide, you have to mechanically treat something. Otherwise, you've gone from forest to chaparral, and it's going to stay that way for a long, long time. And I know the Donna Ridge fire in Truckee, 1962, to this day, where it hasn't been treated, is solid chaparral. There's not a tree in it. So now we realize the mistake, and we're trying to catch up, and it's actually a little bit hopeless to catch up because there's so much land to treat. So there are different strategies about which lands to treat, how to take care of at least trying to slow down the wildfires that inevitably will occur. So there's fire mitigation strategies, including mechanical treatment of fuels, prescribed fire, or usually both. And so you see different operations going on there. I'm going to get more specific here in a minute. This is a before and after picture in our North Lake Tahoe site, where before we had a lot of white fir in the understory and ladder fuels, and then after you're making it look more like that pre-European condition, or before, pre-fire suppression condition at least, open. And then the idea is that after, in the after condition, you never let it grow up like that again. You come in there and burn it frequently. And there are problems with that, as we'll discuss in a minute. Mainly the burn window and the restrictions of air quality standards and so forth, that, and the danger of it escaping to become a wildfire and so forth. But that's the ideal. We'll go back to that, get the understory out, and go back to a regular prescribed fire interval. So this is what Kim supplied me. The problem with this residue in the forest in the Sierra Nevada is it's very distributed and not economical to haul a bunch of chips or residue to the cogen plants and or anywhere else and make any money off. They can make some money off the timber that can be removed if they're allowed to remove it, but the residues typically aren't worth anything. And so she says, well, that's not the, and they have to, I said the word subsidize, and she cringed. You know, they don't like the word subsidize. So what we're talking about is the value of the treatment has to be compared to the value of the averted losses due to wildfire. So I just did a back of the envelope calculation for the Angora fire. That would have been a pretty clear case, 50,000 per acre averted loss. Now, in many cases, you don't burn that many houses in a wildfire. The Gondola fire didn't burn any houses, so it was cost of suppression plus rehabilitation. So you end up with probabilities. So the averted losses are suppression costs plus the cost of the fire to the public plus ecosystem goods and services lost from a wildfire, however you can calculate that. And when you look at it that way, then these treatments become quite economical. Wildfire suppression costs, reduced probability of wildfire times a reduction in suppression costs of wildfire that occur. I should have stolen some pictures from Dan Neary or Malcolm North that show that when a wildfire comes along and hits one of these areas that's been cleaned up, it goes to ground. It stays out of the canopy. And that's, they're very effective that way. They keep, even when the wildfire is already in the canopy, apparently it goes to ground and stays on the ground for whatever length of area has been treated. So they're very effective. Cost to the public, property, livestock, grazing, respiratory health benefits, visibility, water quality, and so forth. Reduction in the value of ecosystem goods and services from wildfire, hunting days, quality of hunting days, and they somehow are able to quantify all of these things. But again, she hasn't done this for the Sierra Nevada system yet. I just dragged her into this talk fairly recently. She has done it, however, for the Great Basin, and here are some of her estimates of fire suppression cost savings, quite a tremendous variation. And this is pinyon juniper encroachment onto grazing areas. ranging here from $80 in cheatgrass dominated to all the way from $32,370 in the pinyon juniper system. I suspect that if we can get her to do this kind of thing for Tahoe, it's going to be a lot bigger than this. The average will certainly be a lot bigger than this. So a few issues about mechanical treatment versus fire. Economics, benefits equal averted losses from wildfire. Costs, it's less expensive than burning. Burning is very expensive because you have to have big crews waiting around, pumpers ready to go to put it out or control it in case it tries to get away. Cogeneration with chips, if it's chip, the residues are chip, does not return a profit due to hauling costs. Cogeneration can defray, however, the costs of the chip removal from the site. The operations window, 6-7 months a year. The feasibility, again, by talking to all the underground people I have ever talked to around the area, plus Roger Walker, the forester author on this paper, we're never going to catch up with this. It's just, there's too many acres. Kim says, well, there's a lot of unemployed people. If you got the money, maybe you could do it. I don't know. But there's a lot of land to treat. Some high visibility areas like South Lake Tahoe, like Lake Tahoe, are being treated right now very intensively. Other areas, you've gone to this approach of, there's my pointer, defensible fuel profile zone. It used to be shaded fuel break, now it's called that, DFPZ. You treat strips half to 1 kilometer wide in strategic locations where you think that you can stop the wildfire. So you're going to let the wildfire burn and then have it go to ground there and try to defend it, stop it at that point. Prescribed fire benefits, again, you have averted losses due to the wildfire costs. It's more expensive than mechanical, as I just mentioned. No available offsets for treatment costs. You don't get anything. Burn window for broadcast prescribed fire is 1 month a year at best, sometimes 0 months per year, and 3 months per year maybe with slash pile burning. Feasibility, again, you can't treat the entire acreage. It's really not going to happen. And you have small acreages per burn. It's very, very labor intensive. So now I'm going to look at some case studies we've done over the years. We've had several wildfire and prescribed fire studies around the area, but right now I'm going to look at the ones that are underlined. Truckee prescribed fire in 2001 and the North Lake Tahoe prescribed fire in 2003, both of which included both fire and a mechanical treatment. The Truckee study included thinning, both whole tree thinning and cut to length, which was a bowl-only thinning in which the branches and the top and the foliage were taken off, left on site in rows of slash mats up and down the hill. And I'll show you what that looks like. And then we had no harvest, and then we had fire and no fire. So we had a total of 6 treatments, 5 replicate plots per treatment. There's a picture of what the cut to length looked like, whole tree thinning, and this is the slash mats left behind. Actually, some of these slash mats were over knee high in rows up and down the hill. And then there's skid trails with just some foliage left on the ground with very much, even the native forest floor removed in the skid trails with the whole tree thinning. We had a nighttime burn in June 2002. Pretty good burn. Burned about half the forest floor, which is typical of these kinds of prescribed fires. And afterward, the skid trails in the whole tree harvest area didn't burn. They just didn't have enough fuel to carry it, so they had to light it on both sides of the skid trails. In the slash mat areas and the cut to length, there was very intense burning, but the large woody material was left behind. It didn't burn. Well, it just charred. Here's Roger's fuels paper, which he published in 2006. So with no harvest, you're looking at these different fuel categories, 100 hour, 0 to 100, 100 to 1,000, and over 1,000. And you can see this much forest floor fuel was consumed. Here's the cut to length, which had, of course, a much higher amount of total fuel left on the ground. And about two-thirds of that was consumed. Again, the large material got left behind. And then the whole tree thinning, we had a consumption of what was left, a lot of the native forest floor as well. So is Roger's statement's prescription fire consumed all additions in the 1 to 100-hour time lag generated by cut to length plus a portion of pre-existing fuels, native forest floor? Consumption of 1,000-hour fuels generated during harvest was minimal. The greater the amount of fuel present, the greater the amount of fuel consumed. And we looked at a lot of things in the Truckee site. My poor student, James Murphy, made all kinds of measurements there, looking for soil solution, resin-based measurements, soil chemistry, and he found no effect of hardly anything at all. The poor guy, and I said, well, this is okay, James. I mean, it means that they can do this with impunity in the future. But we did see substantial treatment effects on carbon and nutrient export and harvested material, of course, and by burning of the volatile nutrients lost by burning. And Wally Miller's graduate student has worked there in looking at O-horizon interflow and water quality, and they found substantial effects on water quality in the interflow, whereas we saw nothing in the soil because the kinds of things he sees in the interflow include ammonium and orthophosphate, which don't get into the mineral soil because they're absorbed. So there's forest floor changes, James Murphy's paper. No treatment, cut to length, whole tree. So we lost carbon, nitrogen is volatile. We lost sulfur in this treatment, it's volatile. Not so much calcium because it's not volatile. Less phosphorus, potassium, and magnesium. So it's kind of a textbook study of the volatile versus the non-volatile nutrient losses. This is looking at the cut-to-length study only. So what about the residues, since this paper is all, or this presentation is all about residues? So here we have left behind the native, there's the native forest floor. There's the residue left behind from logging residue, and there's the understory, which turned out to be a very minor component of the system that burned up. And then there's after fire, right there. We did get the ash. We came with dust busters and sucked up the ash and didn't get, we pretty much got the ash and not mineral soil particles in there. So the difference is what was consumed in the cut to length. So you can see a lot of carbon consumed, a lot of nitrogen consumed, including a lot of the native forest floor, and potassium, magnesium, calcium. So these are non-volatile. The way they had to have been consumed was by advection, simply going up in the plume as ash and leaving the site, because they don't volatilize. And then we had a lot of sulfur consumption. And phosphorus loss as well. Probably, once again, that was mostly lost in convection. And if we did this for the whole tree study, we'd see no losses of the non-volatile elements. And there's the complete nutrient budget where we looked at both the fire and the harvest removal. And interestingly, if you have no harvest, of course, then the only loss is fire. If you have the cut-to-length harvest, most of the carbon and most of the nitrogen loss is due to burning, not harvesting. And on the other hand, if you have a whole tree, most of it's due to harvesting rather than burning, but there's no significant difference between the two. So you can burn it up or you can haul it away. It really doesn't make that much difference in this particular case. On the other hand, for the less volatile nutrients, the whole tree harvesting, where you're removing that nutrient-rich foliage, you're removing considerably more phosphorus. Sulfur is one of the volatiles, behave like nitrogen. And back to the other comment, that you remove a lot more potassium, calcium, magnesium with whole tree harvest. Those are the ones that tend to get left behind more so in the ash with fire. For water quality, this is Wally's runoff collector. It's actually O-horizon interflow. You put this little flashing right here, right at the soil O-horizon interface, and collect the water. We collect it under snowpack. In the actual entry hole, there is just 0.1 4 or 5 centimeters in diameter. So it's an extremely small hole, and it collects a lot of runoff water. The soils are hydrophobic in summertime, so the water runs over the top of them, runs through the O-horizon, and picks up very high concentrations of nutrients because there's no rooting in the O-horizon, and there's mineralization with no rooting. So these nutrients are moving around, and they're going in someplace, either into Lake Tahoe or into a hot spot somewhere in the soil. So this is, there were no effects of harvest on O-horizon interflow water quality, but there were significant effects of fire. And here's the pre and post burn. I think this had to be the cut to length. And you'll see an ammonium pulse. This is very typical after fire. Ammonium gets mobilized by soil heating. And then a little while later, as the nitrifiers begin to wake up or recover from being killed by the fire or whatever, you see a nitrate pulse. And this is not unusual for what we see in the Sierra Nevada. Ortho-P, there was a little bit of a delay also, but sulfate responded immediately, and usually we see a very, very large response to sulfate in solutions, both soil solution stream and O-horizon interflow, usually. The other case study, North Lake Tahoe, and it was a mixed conifer forest, much wetter and more productive than the Jeffrey Pine Forest at Truckee. We had no harvest, had cut to length, except this time it was chipped. The residues were chipped, then we had burn, and then we had burn plus harvest. So there's the chipper. Of course, the chips take the fuels and put them down to a low level. You get rid of the latter fuels, and you get a concentrated fuel, a more contiguous fuel on the forest floor. And there's what the chips look like. Actually, the coverage was usually more spotty than that. And then here's a fire in the no-treated area, which was actually pretty bad. It was dangerous. Nobody would do that. There was too much ladder fuel in there. But for experimental purposes, they did. And it took one plot, pretty much made a wildfire out of it. And that's what was left afterwards. And there's the fuel again. They had the no harvest and cut to length plus chip. And again, there was more fuel left on site with the chipping operation. The understory in this case was not chipped. They just ran over it. The only thing that was chipped was the tops from the thin material. So there wasn't quite as much residue left behind. Same thing. For fuel consumption, prescription fire consumed all fuels generated by mechanical treatments plus a portion of the native forest floor. The amount consumed was proportional to the amount present. And here's our forest floor carbon and nutrient content pre and post. Lost some carbon in both treatments, lost nitrogen. I can't explain these apparent increases in sulfur, calcium, magnesium. I don't know how to explain that yet. There's not enough fuel to have been consumed to have that much occur in the ash. Could have been some soil organic matter combustion in these hot fires that released this. I don't know yet. I can't explain that. But we did have, if you just look at the harvest treatment, we did have loss of carbon, nitrogen, sulfur, but not the non-volatiles. So I probably should have just taken this out so it wouldn't look so bad. Same kind of analysis as before. This is in the harvest and burn treatment only. There's a native forest floor carbon plus residue, not so much residue this time. And then there's after the fire. So this, you can think of this residue as what might be available for cogeneration or energy biomass. Removing the forest floor is also desirable in these systems because it's the source of, basically we think it's the source of that polluted water that Wally's been measuring in the O-horizon runoff. And plus it's a fuel that people would like to get rid of. They'd like to reduce the forest floor amount. So how you would scoop that up and make biofuel out of that, I'm not sure. And then you have the non-volatile nutrients here, calcium, potassium, magnesium, and phosphorus. There are the nutrient budgets. In this case, the harvest-only treatment had much less material removed, just so happened to be porous stocking. But there again, you have most of the carbon removed by harvest, and when you have both treatments, most of the nitrogen removed by fire. And for sulfur, about 50-50. For phosphorus and the rest of the nutrients, harvest was really the only significant removal, because there was either more left behind in the ash or the same amount left behind in the ash after the fires. The water quality O-Horizon runoff was very complicated and not at all straightforward. Here are the concentrations pre and post. Nitrate, ortho-P, you see the kinds of concentrations that are shown even in the unharvested, unburnt. You're up to 3 parts per million ortho-P just floating around in this O-Horizon runoff. It's a source of pollution, and it's being leached from the forest floor. And if it goes into Lake Tahoe, then it's going to pollute Lake Tahoe. And so one of Wally's theories is that because of fire suppression, we've had a buildup of forest floor, and that very forest floor has been a source of phosphorus and nitrogen pollution in Lake Tahoe. And that's probably one of the reasons for the Lake Tahoe decline. So far, he's not getting a lot of traction with that, but it seems like a reasonable hypothesis, because clearly it's there. The highest concentrations were in the untreated situation here. If you look at amounts, actual loads, and we do not know how to quantify the area from which this comes. We think it's around 10,000 square centimeters, but that's just a guess. You start looking at amounts, you get a little bit of a different picture. There's the amount of water, and then the nitrate loading, just milligrams per collector, ortho-P, ammonium. It's a very mixed bag. Basically, the variation with season turned out to be more significant than treatment effects in this case for water quality, except for sulfate, where you have the unharvested burned and you had a really big pulse of sulfate. And again, sulfate turns out to be one of the biggest responders to fire that we see every time. So, Teresa Lupi published a paper in JEQ in 2009 on this, and the background variation is greater than treatment effects for inorganic N and P. Burn and harvest had minimal effect, was comparable to no treatment. Unharvested burn sites had the highest sulfate, and again, it responds typically more than any other nutrient. Finally, slash pile burning, we just finished a study on that and are attempting to get it published. It's been turned down by the SSSAJ for reasons I can't comprehend, but we'll give it another shot. In this case, the slash is piled, the woody material and everything's put into a pile, and when they burn it, it burns everything. There's nothing left. You can see the ash behind all my words there. It's gone. There's no woody material behind. And it's very intense, can last a week. On the west side, I've seen slash piles half as big as this room burning for weeks on end. So you can have quite a significant effect there. And that's Brittany Johnson, who did the master's thesis on this. We had two burns in Little Valley. This is from ranging in a transect from plot center to outside the plot. Total soil carbon and total soil nitrogen. You see that we had a reduction of about 50% total soil carbon in the middle of the plot. And in this fall burn, we didn't have it. Might have been due to the little different size piles. We're not really sure. It might have been due to soil moisture. As you can see, you can have quite a degradation of, quote, soil quality in the middle of these plots, but there's a very small area involved. So does it really matter over time? Not too sure. Soil mineral nitrogen is always enhanced with fire unless you really go over the top, and we didn't quite go over the top yet. There's still some enhancement of soil mineral nitrogen in both cases. And again, soil sulfate, always very responsive. So summary and conclusion, economics, fire mitigation treatments result in averted costs of wildfire suppression, not to mention other costs. Mitigation using prescribed fire is more expensive than mechanical. Using residues for biofuels makes sense. It'll help defray the cost of mitigation. They won't make money in themselves. So the guy has to turn up at the mill and say, I want my averted cost of wildfire put into this payment you're going to give me and see how far he gets with that. That's the problem. For carbon and nitrogen, net ecosystem losses with mechanical treatment and fire about equal to those with mechanical plus residue removal or whole tree thinning. For the less volatile nutrients, the removal with whole tree thinning, in other words, if you took the residues and used them for biofuels, would be much greater. So does that matter or not? It depends on the site. It depends on whether those nutrients are even close to being a problem. But there will be more removal with residue removal for biofuels. Water quality. There's some things that I didn't have time to get into here. Treatment effects on O-horizon and interflow. Previous research has shown the high concentrations of inorganic NNP in the interflow are associated with greater masses of forest floor material. Fire can result in short-term pulses of inorganic NNP, of course. But then after that, as you remove the source of this leachate, then it should be lower down. We have not tested that yet because we haven't been measuring long enough. So the long-term effects of leaving logging residues or extra forest floor on site should be negative in terms of water quality if these residues leach. If they're high CN ratio residues, maybe they'll consume nitrogen. We just really, it's a very complicated situation that needs more monitoring. And that's it.